Hour is supported by the Depot Theater, the Adirondack's only Actors Equity affiliated company. Physically distant, artistically connected, professionally produced. Learn more at depottheater.org. And by NCC Systems, a veteran-owned company protecting North Country businesses and homes for 48 years, offering cameras, security, fire alarms, and entry control. NCCSystems.com. This is North Country Public Radio. It's 8:07 today on Friday, April 16th. Good morning. I'm Monica Sandreski. Todd has the day off, but he will be back on Monday. The Adirondack Park Agency is voting on two big construction projects today. We'll hear more on that, plus the latest regional news in just a minute. But first, we want to focus in on one global issue with local impact. Military burn pits are open-air pits where everything from human waste, everyday trash, to tires are burned using jet fuel, something that's not allowed in the United States and several allied countries because of the human health and environmental risks associated with burning trash. Right now, the VA denies 80% of claims for diseases linked to the toxic fumes from burn pits. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has co-sponsored legislation to make it easier for veterans exposed to military burn pits to get health benefits. Our reporters Celia Clark and Ryan Finnerty spoke more about burn pits. Ryan was a U.S. Army officer, actually, before becoming a journalist.
So, Ryan, to start, are these burn pits still being used, and why? Like, why not landfills?
Yes, as far as we know, they are still in use. A 2019 report from the Pentagon indicated that there were still 9 active burn pits across 3 countries, Afghanistan, Syria, and Egypt. Burn pits were typically used in combat areas or locations without robust infrastructure because they were easy to build and cheap to operate. They'd typically be located on one of the sprawling bases commonly used by the military as logistics hubs in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they could be quite large, some as big as 10 acres, although there were lots of smaller pits used as well. And you asked why they would be used versus something that's a little safer or more environmentally friendly. One big reason, in addition to the ease, is the cost. And many of these burn pits were operated by private, for-profit military contractors that have become such a feature of the post-9/11 war on terror. And those countries have a profit incentive to keep costs down. So burn pits were an attractive option for them.
So, wow, 10 acres is really big. Does that mean that troops could be exposed to the burn pit fumes even if they didn't work directly at the pits?
That's exactly right. The thick black smoke from these pits would commonly hang over bases where a burn pit was located, which meant that anyone in the area could be exposed to airborne toxins from burned plastic, human waste, and the aerosolized jet fuel. Sometimes active duty troops guarded burn pits, but many would just be working on the base, and they could all be exposed. You know, if anyone's everyone in the North Country is familiar with what happens to car exhaust in the cold weather, it just kind of sits lower to the ground and sinks down and sits there. Similar dynamics could be observed in Afghanistan, where it would get really cold in the wintertime. So this was not a localized thing. A lot of people were potentially exposed to some of these environmental pollutants.
So this was overseas. So are burn pits and the problems from them part of all overseas U.S. military installations?
No. They are much more limited than the entire footprint of the U.S. military, which is in many, many countries. And in most of those places, or many of those places, the U.S. military is held to very strict environmental rules, just like they are here in the United States. places like Germany or Japan, where there are local environmental regulations, the U.S. military is held to that standard. But that's typically not the case in these combat zones or support areas that are, providing logistical support to combat zones. The VA lists 9 countries where burn pits were commonly used across Central Asia, the Horn of Africa, and the Middle East. So it's not everywhere the U.S. military is, but in a pretty wide area where many, well over a million troops have rotated through over the last 20 years of war. And it just seems to be like the next example of environmental illness that's been associated with many modern wars. We had Agent Orange in Vietnam, which caused a lot of health problems years later. There was also Gulf War Syndrome from the first Iraq War that's still not very well understood. And it seems like burn pits are going to be the example of that from the War on Terror.
What are some of the health problems people are reporting from being exposed to burn pits, and what is the VA doing about them?
It really is a wide range of conditions. Active duty troops and veterans have reported everything from breathing problems to rare cancers. And it's the link between burn pits and these conditions is not well established scientifically, much like the environmental conditions we mentioned from Vietnam and the Persian Gulf War. The VA has been very slow to recognize that connection and to establish a clear link between individual health conditions and exposure to burn pits. What they have done is create a registry where veterans can sign up and document their particular health condition and what their exposure to burn pits was, where and when that occurred. But that doesn't guarantee that the VA will cover treatment for those conditions or even recognize that it's service-connected at all. And that's really what Senator Gillibrand's legislation is aiming to change and guarantee that veterans with exposure to burn pits will be able to get treatment for whatever health problems have arisen as a result of that exposure.
That was NCPR reporters Celia Clark and Ryan Fitterney. It's 8:14. You're listening to the 8 o'clock hour right here on North Country Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Monica Sandresky. Just ahead, a group of theater students in Plattsburgh worked with their professor to write, block, and direct a reimagining of Shakespeare's Hamlet that shows that Ophelia was no shrinking violet. We'll have more on that coming up here on the 8 o'clock hour in just a few minutes. The 8 o'clock hour is supported by Barstow Subaru Potsdam, committed to the safety and security of all-wheel drive. Details at barstowsubaru.com. Support also comes from the Adirondack Foundation and the Adirondack Birth to Three Alliance, dedicated to providing all children the best possible start in life. AdirondackBT3.org. Support also comes from listeners just like you. NCPR's spring fundraiser starts Monday. And if you've already made your spring contribution, thank you so much for your support. Your name has been entered in all of our spring fundraiser prize drawings, including our Early Bird Special, a $1,000 Spring Project Visa gift card. If you haven't made your contribution yet, now is a wonderful time to show your support and get your name in the hat at ncpr.org/give. Lewis County is reporting that a resident died of COVID-19 this week. It's the third COVID-related death reported in the North Country this week. One person also died in Clinton County, and a third person died in Warren County. On Thursday, St. Lawrence County reported 20 new cases of the virus. The Washington County Health Department reported 27 new cases, and Jefferson County reported 39 new cases of coronavirus. In the 10 prominent North Country counties and southern Akwesasne, over 500 new cases have been reported since Monday. Find more information about vaccine clinics near you at our website, ncpr.org. A virtual rally in support of a bill to allow terminally ill New Yorkers to end their lives featured former public radio talk show host Diane Rehm, who's among those advocating for the Aid in Dying Act. Karen DeWitt reports from Albany.
Rehm's husband, who had late-stage Parkinson's disease in 2014, stopped eating and drinking in order to hasten his death, a painful act that took 10 days. The Rehms lived in Maryland, which, like New York, does not allow medical aid in dying. She says the COVID-19 pandemic, where over 500,000 Americans have lost their lives, has made people even more aware of end-of-life issues.
Now, people realize more than ever that dying could come at any time, and we must be prepared for it. We must talk to our friends, our relatives, our doctors, our loved ones about what we want and take that conversation to the state legislature.
The bill, sponsored by Senator Dianne Savino in the Senate and Amy Paulin in the Assembly, has not yet advanced to the Health Committee in either house. Supporters say many lawmakers already backed the bill, and they say they hope they can convince enough other members to see it become law. Governor Andrew Cuomo has already said he backs the concept. Opponents include the Catholic Church and some conservative groups. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
North Country Public Radio and WPBS are partnering with Diane Rehm for a conversation with her about medical aid in dying. You can join us next Thursday, April 22nd at 6 o'clock for an online panel discussion moderated by North Country Bookmarks host Jessica Lawrence. The event is free, and you can get a link to RSVP by visiting ncpr.org/bookmarks. The state attorney general has found that a car accident in 2019 involving a member of the Washington County Sheriff's Office that killed one woman was not caused by criminal conduct. There's no body-worn camera or dashboard camera footage of the collision, but the investigation did find that Deputy Sheriff Corey Winch fell asleep while driving and hit Susan Harrington's car. However, investigators concluded the officer did not engage in any criminal conduct, like text or using the patrol vehicle computer. The Attorney General's office has recommended several changes for the Washington County Sheriff's Department, including installing lane departure warning systems that send a signal to the driver when the vehicle veers off course. Two major construction projects in the Adirondacks are up for approval today. The Adirondack Park Agency Board will vote on a solar park in Ticonderoga and an apartment complex in Lake Placid. Emily Russell has the details.
The apartment complex in Lake Placid would be a big project if it gets approved. The developer is Joe Barlisle. He's a former Olympic luger whose company developed the White Face Lodge. Barlisle wants to build 355 units across more than 20 buildings. Most of those units would be apartments for rent. They'd first get used as athlete housing during the 2023 World University Games. After that, 90 condos would also get built on the property. The APA says those would sell around $600,000 each. At the APA's meeting yesterday, board member Daniel Wilt brought up the issue of affordability. Lake Placid has been struggling for years with low housing supply, particularly for lower-income folks. Here's Wilt.
Is there any regulation or is there a factor for low-income housing in this project at all?
APA staff said 37 of the apartments will be for people making around or less than the median income of the area. If approved by the board today, the project would be built about a mile west of downtown where there's an old vacant science center. The board will also vote today on a solar project in Ticonderoga. The plan is to cover about 50 acres of land 2 miles northwest of downtown. Board member Art Lucy asked what would happen with the energy produced by the 5-megawatt facility.
you know, I'm selfish. I think the energy produced in the park should power the park before it's shipped out of the park.
APA staff said the project will power an estimated 1,500 homes in the area. Both projects got initial approval on Thursday and will go to the APA board for final approval today. Emily Russell, North Country Public Radio.
Keep up on news throughout the day. Follow NCPR on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and find stories all the time at ncpr.org. It's 8:21. You're listening to the 8 o'clock hour here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Monica Sandreski. Todd does have the day off today. Well, in just a minute, we'll hear two stories of ladies celebrating ladies. It's not Galentine's Day, but heck, might as well be. We'll hear about an empowering take on one of Shakespeare's characters, plus two women musicians perform classical music by two female composers in a show in Elizabethtown tomorrow. We'll jump into those stories in just a minute, but first let's take a look at the weather. Right now it's 34 degrees in Old Forge and in Lake Clear, 37 degrees in Queensbury, 36 in Keysville, and 4 degrees Celsius in Kingston. We can expect a wintry mix today. Snow showers for parts of the region right now, becoming rain for much of the area. Highs in the 40s today, warming up and clearing out a little bit tomorrow. And on Sunday, cloudy skies expected with highs in the 50s as we head into the weekend. But for a more thorough look at the forecast, let's hear from John Warren.
This is John Warren from the New York Almanac with your look at outdoor recreation conditions around the Adirondacks for this weekend. Until now, we've had a warm and dry early spring. Ice is out on most lakes and ponds. According to the Au Sable River Association, Mirror Lake and Lake Placid iced over on December 11th, and ice out was last Friday, 114 days. That's 12 days sooner than the average of their records. Local ice records show that, in general, lakes are ice-free about 3 weeks more than they were in 1900. The Adirondacks is now seeing some much-needed precipitation. The cooler, wetter weather looks to be with us at least until the middle of next week. That will keep waters cold. Most remain in the lower to mid-40s. Be sure to wear a PFD and use cold water protection in small boats. The water temperatures at the south end of Lake George and at Mirror Lake will be in the mid-40s this weekend. The dam on the lower Bog River, the lower Lowe's Dam, has a leak and the water is being lowered by DEC. It doesn't look serious, and when the gate on the lower dam road is reopened after mud season, paddlers are expected to be able to paddle to Hitchens Pond, albeit in a narrower channel and with some obstacle showing. This weekend, rivers and streams will be at about normal springtime levels. Some water crossings may be difficult, and conditions will remain muddy in the central Adirondacks, especially at higher elevations. Stick to lower elevation trails outside the high peaks at this time of year to give those trails a break during a time when much damage can be done. Summit temperatures are expected to remain mostly in the 20s through the weekend. Keep an eye on the weather and plan to encounter mud, ice, and snow and some blowdown on trails this weekend, especially above about 1,500 feet. DEC's mud advisory remains in effect. Avoid hiking in the high peaks, Giant Mountain, Mackenzie Mountain, and Sentinel Range wilderness areas. Those are the local outdoor conditions in the Adirondacks this weekend. For North Country Public Radio, this is John Warren from the New York Almanac, online at newyorkalmanac.com.
So I want to tell you a bit about the current show from the SUNY Plattsburgh Theater Department. They're doing this modern conception based on the character Ophelia from Shakespeare's Hamlet. And if you remember, Ophelia is the young woman who starts to go crazy because she's caught in between her dad and her brother's view of her as this eternal virgin and Hamlet's desire of her as a sex object to toss aside later. A lot of people say Shakespeare wrote her as kind of one-dimensional and as someone just taken over by the men in her life. So SUNY Plattsburgh theater professor Laura Jean Schwartau wanted to reimagine her. So she worked with her students to conceive, write, and film this empowering new take called the Ophelia Perspective. And Schwartau did something pretty cool. She had the whole group of students bring ideas for the plot and how to direct it, trying to make this devised piece truly egalitarian. And also, too, it's virtual. It's COVID, so it's virtual, but it's not your average Zoom theater where it's just people sitting at their computers. The students got really creative with how to film outdoors and indoors in a COVID-safe way. Plus, they also used interpretive dance sequences and sort of video. So we'll hear now from students Mason Barber, the co-director, Bella Anderson, who played the lead role of Ophelia, and Ben Jones, the cinematographer, who also wrote all the music. And we'll start off hearing from Professor Schwartau, who says this piece is like 6 months in the making.
All the cast and the crew agreed to meet, I think we met 7 or 8 times before the semester started. Plus, the students would pick their favorite quotes out, and we tried to weave those into the story.
Bella and Mason, I see you two nodding there.
Yes.
What was that like for you? I mean, to conceive of this piece together as a group.
We came into this with like a very set view of who Ophelia is, right? You take all the stuff from Shakespeare, and I wanted to be able to portray her so that way people could recognize those old characteristics. But I wanted her to be a strong, for lack of better terms, a strong, confident, independent woman. I wanted her to be able to be that, but also have those fragile qualities and those emotional moments that she experiences in Hamlet. And I hope I did it well. And LJ definitely was there the whole time, you know, giving me pointers and saying, hey, maybe we should try this instead. And I think that's also the beauty of a devised piece, is that you have those moments to, you know, try something new here. And if it doesn't work, you change it because you're making up your own dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, at first I thought, you know, casting Bella, because I've seen her range and I knew she could do, you know, emotional. And then she played her scenes very strongly. And I was going to say, well, why don't you try it a little bit softer? But I saw her point of view, and I kind of went over to her interpretation. So that was really exciting to have the actor kind of shape my point of view.
It's just really impressive how much of an ego you don't seem to have at all. I'm the professor. I'm the director. I can overrule what's happening here, you know?
Yeah, right. It's funny. I did have to, you know, bite my lip a few times and go, just listen, listen. But every time I did that, instead of, you know, shutting somebody down and saying, well, no, it has to be this way, or no, it has to be this way, I think we gained a better avenue to travel.
Mason, had you directed a piece before?
I've directed small stuff and student stuff, but department, professional, this is like the first one. So I'm very grateful for LJ for taking me under her wing and like helping me through this. Get a thumbs up.
He and I and everybody, we really complimented each other's ideas and built on them. And it was just such a beautiful process, I have to say. I think we all felt that. And then to do it in the film world, because we couldn't do it live, was such a different aspect. And that's when I asked Ben to get on board, because he's the real star of this. Ben did the original music, composed and performed it.
Ben, what were maybe some of the things that were the most challenging to you in that?
Well, because I know it's supposed to be like a theater type piece, but when I was doing like certain camera movements or camera shots or angles, I was like, I should make this more like if it's going to be a film rather than a theater production. So like, I remember that me and Ben Wright made like a custom camera dolly to like gently move when people are walking through the ward following them. Like I told actors to like stay put when I switched to different shots. Like I did over the shoulder shots. Like at the end, there's kind of like this big angry breakout between two characters where they kind of have like a mini fight. And I had to like tell them to do the exact same moves, stand in the exact same spots while I did 2 different camera angles, 2 different takes of it and stuff like that. Mainly just a lot of repeating certain things. I tell them to repeat stuff and I was like, okay, I'm going to do like 3 takes of this and you have to repeat the same exact action in the same spot. So it's kind of different, like, as opposed to a theater production where it's kind of all in one take. Movie magic.
And also, I have to say, we had to indulge Ben's heavy metal, hard rock music a little bit. He gets it in there here and there. I was trying to thwart him all the way through, but it is appropriate. Where it is, it's a very appropriate. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well-placed hardcore music. There is a time and place for that.
Definitely. I'm going to put it in there somewhere, I guess.
One thing that I do want to say is this lack of the hierarchy of the director really lends itself to the students having agency. So many people took the challenge, and I saw these student actors and student creative crew. I saw their minds, you know, working. So it was really, that was really exciting.
The Ophelia Perspective from the SUNY Plattsburgh Theater Department. It's free to attend. We just heard a conversation with Professor Laura Jean Schwartow and her students who worked with her in making this piece a reality. Those were students Mason Barber, Bella Anderson, and Ben Jones. The show runs through Sunday evening. You can find the link at the SUNY Plattsburgh Theater Department Facebook page. Definitely not hardcore music. This is a cello and piano sonata by English composer Ethel Smythe. Can you name any other female composers at all? Well, many of us can't. Less than 2% of pieces in concert halls are composed by women. But cellist Hannah Holman and pianist Rainey Laquana are trying to change that. They're performing with Piano by Nature in Elizabethtown tomorrow night, and they've been working on making recordings by underrepresented composers, including Smythe, who Laquana says was a moving musician and a suffragette.
I guess there were some windows broken at a protest. She was arrested and she did some jail time. And Sir Thomas Beecham, the famous conductor, came to visit his friend Ethel in jail. And he said she had written a hymn to the women's suffragette movement, and she was conducting. She was like up on a balcony and conducting the women choir, the women singing in a choir with a toothbrush. So that's her famous toothbrush story.
From jail?
Yes. She was great. She was a character.
That's awesome. What a rock star.
Yeah. She was a rock star.
And her music, I think, is I don't know, when we play it, there's something like when Rainey and I both played the first movement and the second movement in some of our rehearsals, we both kind of were like, whoa, we just went somewhere. Huh. Right, Rainey? And like there was like goosebumps.
Transporting.
Very hard to
put. You know, in the old days, they used to say, I mean, I heard this as a girl, that, oh, only the special capacities of the male mind, and it transports you through their excellence. And I think what Hannah is saying, it was kind of like, okay, thank you, Ethel Smythe.
Yes, thank you, Ethel Smythe, indeed. Well, Laquana and Holman have played together for years.